You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our speakers. Hazel Rowley is the author of three previous biographies, Christina Stead, a biography, Richard Wright, The Life and Times, and Tête-à-Tête, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre, which has been translated into 12 languages. These are award-winning biographies. And her new book, which she'll discuss tonight, is Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage. Hazel was last here to discuss Sartre and de Beauvoir's amazing relationship, and nothing against the French, as book critic Maureen Corrigan said, but, quote, there's no contest here. While Sartre and de Beauvoir were hashing over gender roles in sequestered cafes, Franklin and Eleanor had already forged their own cutting-edge version of a marriage, despite living for nearly four terms in the fishbowl of the White House. I'm one of those post-war kids, I'm sure there are many of you here, whose mother worshipped Eleanor Roosevelt. In fact, one of my mother's proudest moments was having been invited to tea with Eleanor at the White House, and I only wish I could tell you why, but not going to find out. In this groundbreaking new account of the marriage, Hazel Rowley describes the remarkable courage and lack of convention, public and private, that kept FDR and Eleanor together. She reveals a partnership that was both supportive and daring, and here is one of the most consequential love stories of the 20th century, carried out in the midst of both personal and national challenge. It's a tale as full of betrayals as it is of a fundamental fidelity, and it details a partnership so powerful that it has shaped the lives of all of us who read about it today. The critic in the Washington Post said, if you are going to read only one book about this extraordinary couple, this is the one. And of course, Hazel's book is for sale tonight, courtesy of our library store, and just wanted to remind you that if you do buy it on site rather than on Amazon, you will be supporting also the Los Angeles Public Library as the proceeds benefit the library. We're very, very proud to have Classical KUSC 91.5 as one of Aloud's media sponsors, and we're very fortunate to have Gail Eichenthal as an interlocutor tonight. Nationally, Gail may be best known for her longtime service as host and producer of the Los Angeles Philharmonic broadcasts on NPR. She's no longer doing them, but she began the series in 1978 at age 24, becoming the first woman to host the national radio broadcasts of a symphony orchestra. She's worked in television, hosting arts programs. She's a respected writer, and she's currently program director for Classical KUSC 90 FM 91.5 and the longtime co-host of the weekly radio program Arts Alive, and you'll be able to hear excerpts of this program on that very show. So without further ado, please welcome Hazel Rowley and Gail Eichenthal. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. It's great to see such a nice crowd. Well, this is a book that reads kind of like a suspense thriller in a way. I was amazed at how engaged I was, and I could not stop talking about this book. I was driving my family crazy as I was reading it, as you will too. But I thought it would be nice to begin with a little excerpt from somewhere near the beginning of the book, which kind of establishes the tone of this remarkable relationship early on and some of the challenges that they faced early on. And that will sort of serve as a jumping off point for us and then for your questions as well.
Okay. I thought I'd start with the courtship. The book begins with them. They were cousins, as you know, fifth cousins once removed, so that Eleanor Roosevelt didn't have to change her name. She just changed her politics because the man who would give her away at her wedding was not her father, who died when she was 10, as we'll discuss. It was President Theodore Roosevelt, a progressive Republican, who gave her away at her wedding in March 1905. Anyway, that's coming a little later in the book. I start the book with them, with Franklin and Eleanor, who knew each other as cousins, as kids. They saw each other from time to time. And They meet again on a train by accident going up the Hudson. Franklin was going back up to Hyde Park to the family estate, and Eleanor was going up to Tivoli where she lived with her grandmother, and it was the summer, and they met again. And then in 1903, the end of 1903, Franklin proposed to Eleanor. It was a speedy romance, very romantic. The early photos, I think, show them very much in love, very playful. And so, but they had one problem, which was Franklin's mother. And here I just want to talk a little bit about that. Franklin knew exactly what he wanted. He proposed to Eleanor and chose Eleanor with a kind of sixth sense, I think, that this was the woman he needed, that he would have later when he chose his team. He was remarkably good at choosing the people around him. He was also in love with Eleanor, so I shouldn't just make it sound as if it was instrumental. But he had a problem, which was telling his mother. And for a while after he had proposed to Eleanor, he really didn't want to tell his mother. He kept putting it off. And Eleanor said, you know, you're going to have to tell her. And finally he did, and his mother was not at all pleased. She wrote in her journal, Franklin gave me quite a startling announcement. So I'm reading a little bit. Sarah apparently had no inkling. Naturally, she felt hurt by Franklin's secretiveness, not to mention threatened and betrayed. Franklin was her all, that's what she used to say. And now another woman was making claims on him. She didn't hide her displeasure. She reminded her son that he was only 21 and Eleanor had just turned 19. None of his friends had married yet. His father had been 33 when he married for the first time. Franklin had only just entered graduate school. Next year he was starting law school. He wasn't established in his career. How on earth did he think he could keep a family in the style to which he and Eleanor were accustomed? So Franklin stuck out his chin, as he used to do, just like his mother. But Sarah nevertheless bid for time and told him that she wanted them to keep the engagement secretive for a year. And she quite clearly was hoping that she could turn him against Eleanor. I don't think she thought Eleanor was beautiful enough or mundane enough. And Eleanor was an orphan. So she was somewhat pitied in the Roosevelt family tribe. Skipping a bit, Eleanor had understood the precariousness of her situation. If Franklin's mother didn't like her, she risked losing Franklin. They met one day. The next morning, she wrote to Sarah, who everybody calls Sally. It gets a bit confusing. Dearest cousin Sally, I must write you and thank you for being so good to me yesterday. I know just how you feel and how hard it must be, but I do so want you to learn to love me a little. You must know that I will always try to do what you wish, for I have grown to love you very dearly during the past summer. It's impossible for me to tell you how I feel toward Franklin. I can only say that my one great wish is always to prove worthy of him. With my love, dear cousin Sally, always devotedly, Eleanor. Franklin, meanwhile, was caught between two women. He wrote to his mother on Harvard Crimson notepaper. He was very proud of being the editor of Harvard Crimson. Telling her he was very busy, working into the early hours of the morning on the newspaper and on various committees. Then came this. Dearest Mama, I know what pain I must have caused you, and you know I wouldn't do it if I really could have helped it. Mais tu sais, me voilà. He liked chucking in a bit of French. It just means, that's it, Mum. That's all that could be said. I know my mind, have known it for a long time, and know that I could never think otherwise. Result, I am the happiest man just now in the world, likewise the luckiest. And for you, dear Mummy, you know that nothing can ever change what we have always been and always will be to each other. Only now you have two children to love and to love you. And Eleanor, as you know, will always be a daughter to you in every true way. Franklin had done the unthinkable. He had stood up to his mother squarely and firmly.
But that's not the last we hear about mom, is it?
No.
No.
It isn't.
No. It's a fascinatingly complex relationship that lasts for many, many years. Let's go back to that shy young woman who was considered not glamorous enough, who was gawky, tall, who had been really belittled by her own mother, who was a great beauty, and had lost her father, who was a dissolute drunk. What a tragic childhood she had. How did she get to be so powerful, so ambitious, coming from that background?
Well, actually, that's a question I don't know that I can answer, because it's astounding. I mean, part of the interest of this marriage is the evolution of their marriage from being a completely Victorian marriage between two American aristocrats, worse than conventional because they were under the thumb of his mother, with Eleanor desperately trying to please his mother. But it's also the evolution of Eleanor that is so surprising. And indeed, as you say, she was 5'11", for goodness sake. Photos of her, you know, meeting the King and Queen of England and so on are very funny. He was 6'1", so they were giants. She was thin, gawky. She was told by her relatives frequently that she was an ugly duckling and that she would never find an eligible man. I mean, if you were an American, if you were an aristocrat and a woman at that time in the Victorian era, you better be beautiful, or it was really painful. But somehow she enchanted Franklin. She actually went, well, she was an orphan at the age of 10. Her father was an alcoholic. Her mother never loved her. She could never accept the fact that Eleanor was not a beauty. But I think the saving grace was that Eleanor, from the age of 15 to 18, went to finishing school in England at a place called Allenswood, just outside London. And this school sort of attracted aristocratic young girls from as far away as Australia, actually, also America, Europe, France. The lessons were in French. And Eleanor went from being the orphan who always felt that she was an imposition in her grandmother's household and so on, to being the most popular girl in the school. And I think the headmistress, who actually was a lesbian and who had, her assistant was more or less her companion, but it came out later that she sort of had, there were lots of young girls at the school fell in love with this headmistress. I think in this case it was the other way around. The headmistress fell in love with Eleanor and took her a bit traveling on the continent and so on. She bought some clothes. I mean, she got Eleanor to buy some lovely Paris gowns. And when Franklin meets her at the beginning of my book on the train by accident, he's surprised to see his cousin, who he last saw when she was 14 in a hand-me-down dress at a family party, suddenly wearing a beautiful long Paris dress and looking, her blue eyes were really sparkling. She always had lovely gentle blue eyes, but she had a new sparkle in them. He was very struck by this new Eleanor.
And that really was an important influence on her, wasn't it? The idea that a young woman could be cultivated and could study and could learn on her own, could even have some independence. She did some traveling as well.
That headmistress was hugely important to her. She was surreptitiously teaching these rich girls to think critically, to make up their own mind, the importance of education. She was even teaching them, she was actually rather progressive and teaching them about, the problem of race in America. She was teaching them about, trade unions and the importance of playing a responsible social role. So she had a very strong influence on Eleanor.
Going back to your choice of topic here, I had a hard time avoiding the comparison between Beauvoir and Sartre, whom you spent many years researching in the wonderful book Tête-à-Tête. Also an unconventional, out-of-the-box relationship, to be sure. And this American version, which, as Louise was reading the wonderful critic of NPR saying, there's no comparison. This was even more radical than Beauvoir and Sartre. Are you attracted to the idea of to the study of marriages, or was this a coincidence?
Actually, it was a complete coincidence. I really don't want to be misrelationship, you know. I really, as I talk about in the preface, I went up to the FDR Museum in Hyde Park in the Hudson Valley, which if you have not been to, you've got to go. It's in a spectacular museum. You see the house, you see very... It takes a day to go through it, and you're in the beautiful Hudson. But it just happened that I was on a guided tour where everybody was fascinated by the relationship, and somebody asked the guide what's the best book on the subject, and the guide said it's 40 years old, and my friend and I looked at each other and had the same thought: Hazel, there's your next book. I think we're all interested in relationships. I really didn't intend to write another book about another couple, but there is certainly something which is similar, which is that I'm very impressed by relationships founded on generosity. And the thing about the Roosevelts was that they really allowed each other to be themselves. And in fact, when I say themselves, they pushed each other to their limits. And in other words, I don't think many presidents would have put up with a wife who gave weekly press conferences, who spoke out, who wrote a My Day column every day in the press, who was known throughout the world, not just this country, for being outspoken and really playing a political role, not just the smiling wife. She was tremendously active in politics. Franklin's press secretary, Stephen Early, who was a Southerner, progressive man, except on subjects like race, you know, he would have loved Eleanor to shut up and tried to get President Franklin Roosevelt to shut her up, but he wouldn't. And I came to the conclusion through my research too that FDR could not have been FDR without Eleanor. So, the thing that first attracted me to this story was when I went up to Hyde Park, I thought to myself, here I am in the home of a sheltered aristocrat who at the age of 39 came down with what was known as infantile paralysis. And I mean, he became a paraplegic. I can't stress enough what that means for an athletic, handsome, virile, very physical, very athletic man. I mean, Franklin was the type of guy who used to like going on vacation, you know, riding horseback down some steep hill in Virginia, writing to Eleanor, you know, we slid most of the time on the back of our horses, wish you were here. Eleanor was certainly very glad she wasn't. He went from, you know, and the year before he came down with polio, he was at the Democratic National Convention as vice president, you know, vaulting over a row of chairs to get to the platform in a hurry. This was the man who became a paraplegic. And yet, at the age of 39, and yet at the age of 50, became president of the United States. Unheard of. Eleanor went from being a shy, gawky orphan to being the most progressive, outspoken, courageous, progressive. I mean, she'd come from a Republican background to being a progressive. How did this happen? I have an explanation for how they both transformed themselves: the marriage.
There's a period early on when he becomes involved in politics that she is really his legs. You know, she goes out and makes the calls. She goes out with his other close associates and inspects the naval yards. So she, in a sense, was an extension of him.
Yes.
In his early political career.
Definitely. That was really the turning point. The first 4 years of the marriage weren't particularly happy. Franklin was a lawyer, which he didn't much like. Eleanor had 4 babies in 5.5 years, which she didn't much like. And mother had given them, Sarah had given them a present, like most of her presents. It had a catch. The present was to be a house, wonderful, East 65th Street, Manhattan, double front, twin house. Mama was going to live in the other half, and there'd be connecting doors. So those years were difficult when Eleanor was starting up a family and Mama, as they both called her, was always bustling in. And then 5 years into the marriage, Franklin, at the age of 28, entered politics, and he stood in for the New York State Senate in an area where nobody thought he could run. I should just say that President Theodore Roosevelt, had now left the presidency, so that kind of freed Franklin up to be a Democrat, which he actually always saw himself as being, but he had cast his first vote for Theodore Roosevelt, because Theodore Roosevelt was so progressive. Actually, he was quite like today's Democrats. He wanted to restrain government, and he believed in, restrain big business and so on. But when he was 28, Franklin stood for the New York State Senate up in the Hudson Valley, and he surprised everybody. This was a farming district, absolutely Republican to the hilt, and he won as a Democrat. And they went to Albany for 3 years to live. And it was during that period that Eleanor became interested in politics and never looked back. I mean, she loved politics. And as you said, at first she did it for Franklin, but I think polio was the dividing period in the marriage. 16 years into the marriage, Franklin, when he came down with polio, it was their close friend Louis Howe who said to Eleanor, "You have to keep politics in the family and in the picture." Another important thing had changed. Franklin got polio in 1921. Women in this country got the vote in 1920. So Eleanor was a massive influence on getting women to vote, the Democratic women on board. And then just one other thing, this was by now the 1920s. The Victorian era had ended. Eleanor could cut her hair and stop wearing long dresses at picnics at Campo Bello. And she became friendly with a whole lot of progressive women, former suffragettes on the left of the Democratic Party. And this was now the roaring 20s. It was very different for women. And so just when Franklin got polio, Eleanor sort of, the weights were changed by that, and the times, both.
It did start out as a conventional marriage, and early on in the marriage, she must have been somewhat disheartened to see that he could not resist a pretty face. He could not keep himself from following, whatever flirtatious older or younger woman came on to him, and that happened most very memorably early on during his honeymoon. When he goes for a hike, this reminded me of an early 20th century version of the Elaine May movie where the husband takes off on the honeymoon. This is very haunting, and that's when we start to understand her moodiness, what she realized that she was going to be dealing with. Maybe you can talk about that.
Right. Well, I think Eleanor was moody anyway. I mean, she was very insecure. She had a voracious need to be loved. And you can understand that with her. Her past was as tragic as the most tragic Victorian novel. Her past, which I talk about, is really grueling to read about. I mean, her younger brother died at 5, her parents, death after death after death. And she felt, as an orphan, an imposition on people. Franklin, remember, was the golden boy, doted on by his mother, the only child, very outstandingly good-looking. And, so he liked to flirt, and he, on his honeymoon, went up a mountain in Austria with some woman who owned a hat shop in Manhattan. And
Eleanor didn't like to hike.
Eleanor didn't go up the mountain. I guess it was difficult in long dresses. And I mean, she was very jealous, yes. But I think she would have had the moods anyway. And I think, too, Franklin and Eleanor were not Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. They did not leap into bed with... Well, much has been made of it, and they're very, very different. As we'll talk about, no doubt, they did have very romantic attachments and close companions. As for sex, actually, there wasn't. They were not having affairs with everybody. Yeah. He flirted. He liked to flirt, and especially after polio, I think that was understandable. His sense of manhood had been hugely assailed, and he liked to have adoring women around him. Eleanor was never an adoring woman. She was a woman who expected an enormous amount from Franklin, and he expected
an enormous amount from her. And frankly, that's what made FDR FDR. That's what made Eleanor Eleanor. But, you know, okay, so they went on vacation with, you know, other people. I don't think that that shows that it was the bad marriage that everybody likes to pretend.
Well, one of the highly publicized aspects of their marriage is his relationship, whatever it was, with Lucy Mercer. And that was something that Eleanor discovered when he was quite ill, before polio, but he had, I think, pneumonia. Is
yes.
that right? Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that probably is something that, you know, we all have seen in TV movies and so forth and so on. We think we all know, you
That's
know,
right.
that ties it up. It was a terrible marriage because of Lucy Mercer.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that relationship and how she came to accept certain things about him.
You see, there again, I suspect that Lucy Mercer is made more important than she really was. It's an unfortunate betrayal. When Franklin, during World War I, was Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Washington, it was a very high-powered job. It was the war, and he was busy building up the U.S. Navy and playing a very important role. And I suspect it was a sort of heady time for him. And all the newspapers commented on this Assistant Secretary of the Navy and how good-looking he was. Eleanor, meanwhile, was helping him in his job, even though she used to get seasick. She'd go with him on inspection tours, and she'd, you know, go calling on people and their wives and so on. She was massively helpful to him in his job. And when she found herself pregnant for the fifth time, she got herself a social secretary, some young woman to help her, who was called Lucy Mercer. And already, you see, in the summer, Franklin always insisted that Eleanor and the children disappear to this remote island. Actually, it's Canadian. It's off Maine, called Campo Bello. And I've been there. That's another place that's very interesting for you to visit, because you can see around the Roosevelt House where he came down with polio in 1921 and so on. So he would insist that she take the kids and, you know, and the 50 suitcases and the servants up to Campo Bello, a two-day trek right up to the top of Maine. He couldn't, unfortunately, come this year. He was in Washington working. He'd try to come and so on. So there was rather a lot of time in the summer when he was at home with the servants, doing his job, working very hard, but Lucy Mercer was around. And already in the summer of 1917, definitely Eleanor was getting a little edgy and wanting to come home and so on. And then in 1918, Franklin went to Europe to inspect U.S. naval operations on the front line. And Eleanor, meanwhile, was working extremely hard in a stinking hot Red Cross canteen, providing food for soldiers. When Franklin came back, he had double pneumonia and was carried off the ship in a stretcher. At home, Eleanor unpacked his suitcase and came across a little trove of love letters from Lucy Mercer.
Her secretary.
Her social secretary. An act of betrayal, there's no doubt. I don't try and defend it. But everybody tries to make out that this was a complete turning point in the marriage, that the end of their physical relations and so on and so on. No evidence at all. I'm absolutely sure that Eleanor, first of all, they wrote each other very loving letters immediately, you know, in the month afterwards. There are lots of letters to each other. He called her dearest Babs. She called him dearest honey. They made up. Franklin didn't want a divorce. He knew that the last thing that Lucy Mercer represented was freedom, because actually it didn't look good for a man who had five kids to run off with his wife's social secretary, and I don't think he wanted to. The reason people made a lot of it is that was before he had polio, and by the way, we don't even know whether it was a consummated relationship. There is absolutely no evidence, and in my book I sort of even speculate that it may never have been, not because I'm a Puritan, far from it, but there were reasons which I give where I actually suspect it possibly wasn't. There was perhaps just a lot of passionate necking on the back streets of Virginia in the back of his front of his car, God knows where. But he did keep up a friendship with Lucy Mercer, and particularly in the last years of his life, when she married and when her husband died, he saw her a bit, which meant whisking her into the White House under a false name behind Eleanor's back. And then it happens that she was among the various adoring women who were with Franklin at Warm Springs, Georgia, when he died. So that it was a second very bad betrayal for Eleanor to fly down to Warm Springs to see not just the dead body of her husband, but also learn from the group, because they had to tell her it was going to come out, that Lucy had been there and had made a quick escape. This had to be covered up in the press. But it was an awful moment for Eleanor, and she had to sit in that funeral train going all the way back, slow speed, from Georgia through the Carolinas to Washington, thinking to herself that not only was Franklin dead at 62 and that was the end of the White House, but that Lucy had been there at his death. But I think maybe we have made too much of the Lucy relationship because of those things.
Well, you mentioned press, and it's really fascinating to compare how the press treated him with how, for example, President Clinton was treated by the press.
Oh, God, yes, exactly.
It's just unfathomable. First of all, not only was he having fairly open relationships with other people, as she ended up doing as well, Eleanor ended up doing as well, but his very disability was to some extent covered up.
Yes.
They spent a long time waiting to even tell people what had happened. And once they did, what astounded me reading your book is how much they went to the trouble of minimizing how devastating the disability was.
Yes.
Yeah. And the press completely cooperated with that.
Yes, it is astounding. Well, I mean, they weren't having affairs. Well, they weren't really having affairs during the press, except for the extraordinary coincidence that Eleanor was in love with a woman, a journalist, the most prominent political journalist in the country, just at the time when she entered the White House. And that's an extraordinary story. And there was certainly a physical dimension to their relationship. Everybody therefore says Eleanor was a lesbian. She had a lesbian relationship, but I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that Franklin was the love of her life, and she did sort of fall for other men. Romantic attachments. She always went for men who already had a woman, so it was really just a tremendous outpouring of love and a need to be loved, but she always went for men where it would have been impossible, really, to. The polio thing definitely was sort of strategically covered up by Franklin, by Louis Howe, his close friend and advisor, and indeed by Eleanor. I mean, the fact is that after 1921, when he was 39, Franklin was a paraplegic. He couldn't stand, he couldn't walk a step. It was covered up. Most people in America they all knew he had polio. They all knew he couldn't really walk easily. But they didn't know, or they weren't shown, that there are three photos in existence of him in a wheelchair. You see, this was before television. There were newsreels, but they were heavily censored. And his press secretary, Stephen Early, made damn sure that, you know, the press didn't come till Franklin had been carried out of the car or carried into the car, and you didn't see the carrying up the back steps into the halls. You rarely saw him. I saw some footage of him walking up the drive of the Rhinebeck post office to open that gem of a post office built in the WPA era. If you haven't seen it, Rhinebeck Hudson Valley post office, gorgeous murals and so on. So I saw some footage of him walking up the drive, and even for me, who had read in excruciating detail what it was like for Franklin to pretend to walk, you know, with a cane and with a son on the other arm who he was badly bruising, sweat pouring off his face, and generally with the son, they'd practice the repartee of jokes and laughing to distract the audience so they wouldn't know how extremely painful this was for them both, and they had always counted the steps to the podium, and the podium had been checked so that Franklin could rest on it. I mean, it had to hold his weight. He was meanwhile wearing 10-pound braces on his legs. And so he gesticulated with his head a lot. But nobody knew really all that. He was considered to just... The press cooperated, even the Republican press, which was, by the way, rather like today, 80% of the American press, the Hearst press.
And everybody cooperated. Yes, it's very moving to read about it in the book. Talk about your process as a biographer. I would think with a subject like this, you could do research for decades, you know, and so much has been written. There, she has two volumes of a autobiography and so forth. Two volumes of a biography. She wrote an autobiography.
Eleanor, yes.
Do you set yourself a deadline for, okay, I'm done with research, now I have to write? How does that work?
Well, I agree with you. It could take years. I mean, the Hyde Park Museum, which was, by the way, the first presidential library. Franklin Roosevelt set up the first presidential museum, and ever since, every president has had one. But the archives are amazing. I spent weeks, probably months up there working on the documents, the letters, and so on. I guess I have written three books before this. They get shorter each time. I mean, I think it's actually harder to do, you know.
Sure.
People think that this is short, therefore it's easier. It's short, therefore it's harder. Because, well, I think I'm sort of joining more the Lytton-Strachey school of biography that believes that you can tell things with minimal brushstrokes, just hints, just, you know, you keep that story going, but the detail has to be selected. It's all important in the detail. We don't have as much time as we used to, and there have been innumerable four-volume biographies of Franklin, most of which hate Eleanor, or, you know, two-volume biography of Eleanor, we're waiting for volume 3 by Blanche Vincent Cook. She's not too keen on Franklin. I wanted to write a book that tells the sort of arc of their marriage in a readable, very engaging... I've almost got to the point where I think it's I wouldn't say it's an indulgence to write more, but because I hugely respect the writers who've gone before me. But I'm more interested now in telling the story in a kind of minimalist way and keeping it, keeping it engaging, keeping it... but not omitting important detail. It's just all about selection.
And also, it seems to me, in reading the book, I kept, you know, waiting for, as a fiction fan, who's the bad guy? You know, who's the murderer? It's so shadowed that, you know, there's a dimensionality to these characters. They're very human. They're not perfect.
No.
Neither of them are perfect.
No. None of us.
Do you come to this with preconceived notions about them, and find those notions debunked, or do you really strive to not have a subjective feeling about them? How do you balance that?
Well, I was open to what I would find. If I had found a whole lot of incriminating evidence, it would have been in the book. I believe in honesty. But I also, this question of selection, obviously I'm telling the story and I could always select bits that make them look bad. It's not that I'm not doing that. This is hard to explain because I don't feel in any way that I'm distorting the story. I do believe that I like to show people at their best. It doesn't interest me very much putting in a sentence of Eleanor's which isn't very grammatical. She wasn't terrific at grammar. She wasn't a great writer. Despite the My Day column and her autobiography, she was quite a pedestrian writer. I wanted to show, I don't know, you want to show the essence, you want to show their humour. I guess I knew what I wanted to put in because there was just a little piece in a letter or something that I felt showed me an intriguing little piece of Franklin being playful, affectionate, tender. That has to go in. It sounds stupid to say so. You sort of know what goes in. But I believe in writing dignified biographies. I don't believe in... I believe that I'm a far lesser person than the people I write about, so there would be no way that I would condescend to them or, these were admirable, these were extraordinary people as individuals and as a couple, and I wanted to show you that. But also playful, teasing, fun, insecure, needy, and flirtatious in the case of Franklin.
And I think, you've gone far to explain why it's such an incredibly readable book, I think, because these are very three-dimensional human beings. You are not an American. You were born in London but spent a lot of time in Australia. What kind of perspective does that give you on two of our most famous Americans ever, our most distinguished Americans ever?
First of all, I've got to say that one of the things I most deeply appreciate about this country is that nobody has ever suggested that as an English person or as an Australian, I really shouldn't, approach America's greatest icons. Whereas in France, when I wrote about Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, I was in trouble. I was an Anglo-Saxon who stepped into French territory. And, one said that Hazel Rowley, who lives in New York, is a Puritan, because I'm American, anything. I am an outsider. I'm an outsider everywhere I go. And I guess, don't you think all writers train themselves in a way to be outsiders because you always have to sort of view a little bit with detachment and a little bit from the outside. But when I think about it, these two people were outsiders, so maybe that helped me understand them. Maybe as a non-American, I have a slightly less judgmental attitude to extramarital dalliances, because really I do hasten to add they were not getting into bed with everybody, but they did have these, and they allowed each other. They knew about them. They were people who were in the group. Around them, they were great believers in community. It's not for nothing that FDR constantly in his speeches used the words community, neighbor, friends. That's how they like to live, even in the White House. But as an outsider, it helped me understand them because they were outsiders. They were aristocrats. Traditionally, American aristocrats are Republicans. They are Democrats. They were resented by their family. The Roosevelts were, of course, strict Republicans. The 80 Roosevelts they invited to dinner on Inauguration Day, March 1933, were nearly all Republican voters. Franklin was an outsider because let us not forget what it was to be a cripple. Back then in the 1920s, you were supposed to remove yourself from society and keep out of the way. And yet, Franklin came up with this wonderful, experimental, bold venture, which was Warm Springs, Georgia, yet another place you can go and see where there's a Roosevelt House and Museum, which is fascinating, and the Polio Institute. But no sooner did he go down to these Warm Springs and feel that they were doing him good than he came up with the idea of setting up a community there for other polio victims. And which would be, and it was a startling and successful experiment in America at the time, a very friendly, warm, encouraging community where these polios, as they called themselves, not only did, rather painful exercises with the best specialists and physiotherapists in in the area. But between times, they could talk to each other on their nice porches, their cottage porches, and they had lovely dinners, which Franklin, you know, saw to, and they had picnics. And, I mean, it became a community where people could find themselves again and find a sense of purpose again. This was Franklin being bold like he always was. And it was Franklin thinking about a community. And I deeply admire that about him and about Eleanor.
There's a crucial passage in the book where when you talk about community, these people would actually live with them.
Yes.
They would live with them in the governor's mansion. They would live with them in the White House. There are significant others outside the marriage I'm talking about. And you make the point when they move into the governor's mansion that Eleanor covered for Franklin's relationship with a woman named Missy LeHand, who was his secretary and really his partner.
Yes.
Spent many more months with Missy than with Eleanor, and Eleanor was involved in a sense the cover up of the what was Missy doing living in the governor's mansion. Oh, well, of course she's there.
No. Yes. Well, it wasn't really a cover up. I mean, this was what changed things. Franklin got polio. Okay, before polio, there was Lucy Mercer, unfortunate betrayal. Then came polio. He was 39. From that point on, Franklin needed an attendant at all times. He had a valet to help him dress, to lift him. At first, he had a full-time live-in nurse. Louis Howe, Eleanor and Franklin's very, very close friend and Franklin's political advisor, and Eleanor's, he got Eleanor into politics, moved into this house where Mama was in the other half, in East 65th Street, and he took on Franklin's work. Franklin was still doing legal work and business work, and he was also and so Louis Howe, a wonderful, wonderful character in my book, moves into the house with them. An asthmatic who smoked nonstop and wheezed, and Mama hated him. She called him that dirty little man. But Louis Howe played a crucial role. So from polio onwards, the family became a community because it had to. And then Franklin had to find his sense of life again. I mean, when you think about it, he had political ambitions. In 1920, he was the Democratic vice presidential candidate. Democrats lost, they knew they'd lose. But there's no doubt that Franklin, on his campaign trail with Eleanor beside him, made a dramatic impact on the national stage. He was headed straight for the presidency in 1920. 1921... polio. His dreams were crashed. Doctors later said that Eleanor played a very big role in his mental rehabilitation. She pushed him. His mother wanted him to become an invalid in a wheelchair in Hyde Park so that she could look after him. Eleanor knew that would kill this man. So she kept alive politics and his work and pushed him to walk on crutches, which was very hard. He couldn't support himself on his legs. He hated this painful crutches business. But I've lost the track.
Well, Missy's role.
Missy, sorry. My God, I'd lost the track. So the thing is that he had a secretary already before he had polio, a young woman from Boston called, they called her Missy LeHand. And after polio, there's no doubt that Missy was yet another young woman who was in love with Franklin. They all were. He was extraordinarily, so was Eleanor, extraordinarily magnetic personality. What happened was that for 18 whole months after polio, Franklin was at home in New York and sometimes in the estate in Hyde Park, in a wheelchair, sometimes trying to walk on crutches, dealing with his dreams shattered. One day, 8 months after coming down with polio, it was not a day, it was one night, under cover of darkness, he was taken out for his first drive in a car, but the neighbours mustn't see him with polio being carried out to the car, so it was nighttime. So 8 months, this highly athletic man was stuck at home with a whole lot of family tensions around him, which I describe, you know. And then really it was the beginning of his salvation when he went 18 months after polio down south with his black valet, a wonderful man, with Missy Lahand, his secretary, and, well, she was his secretary at first, and then and a few friends, and they went on a boat. They had a houseboat off the waters of Florida, and Franklin found himself again by, you know, cruising, fishing, swimming. He loved to swim in warm waters, which did his muscles good. And Missy was a loving, adoring, patient, very good secretary, but the kind of woman who, she did adore Franklin, there's no doubt, and he loved her, he treasured her. I don't think he was in love with her. But she was the kind of patient woman who could sit beside him in the South and help him collect stamps, paste in stamps into his albums. That was one of his great passions. And fetch books for him. And she was a patient woman. Eleanor was a woman on the go. She couldn't sit still. She hated the South. She hated the racism. She hated the slowness, She didn't like cocktails, hardly surprising. Not only was her father dead with alcohol, her younger brother died of alcoholism, her uncles died of alcoholism. She hardly touched booze. Franklin, with polio, was cheered up by a nice cocktail, prohibition era, prohibition cocktail. And Missy liked that too. So, I mean, Eleanor wasn't somebody you relaxed with. And... but okay, you know, she had many, many virtues. So he went down south with Missy, and there's no doubt that that was a romantic relationship. And later she moved into the governor's mansion when he became governor of New York in 1928. And later she moved into the White House, and she was by his side. You know, he dictated, you know, she was his secretary. She, whether or not it was physical, I think probably it was, to the, you know, capacity Franklin could. And I talk about that delicately. The fact is, though, it was most certainly a romantic attachment. However, Franklin would never have been in the White House with Missy by his side. And, you know, she did have a propensity to have terrible nervous breakdowns. And there were a few. And then finally, when she was in the White House, she got a stroke in her 40s. And was paralyzed and couldn't speak. Can you imagine? Yet another wheelchair and couldn't speak, and went back to Boston and died at the age of 45, 3 years later. Franklin was very, very good to her, gave her a lot of money. They were always extremely loyal to all their friends. So it's not as if they sort of had romantic attachments and dropped people. Not at all. This is a story of loyalty, incredible loyalty.
Even Eleanor was loyal to Missy.
Missy loved Eleanor, yeah, and was very grateful to Eleanor for letting her be with Franklin. And I think Eleanor was grateful to Missy because she didn't want to go south and play with stamps on boats that made her seasick with the mosquitoes in the south. She hated the whole bit.
Well, we could go on and on. It's an endlessly fascinating chronicle. But I want to open it up to your questions as we have a bit of time. So we have a microphone, and I will call on you. Let's start with this gentleman in the yellow, and then someone over on this side, perhaps. Back row? Yes? No? Anyone on this side? Okay. Young woman in the front row in the turquoise. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering if you could comment from your research on their private attitudes toward race and Jews, blacks and Jews, and how their private maybe thoughts or ideas did not translate into politics.
Right. Well, I think that politics was their life. I mean, politics was their mutual passion. And one of the myths, of the several myths that I debunk in my book, was that Eleanor didn't really, that she was a reluctant first lady, or that she didn't really like politics. Of course she had to say that. I mean, she had to say that, because Franklin, from the beginning, by the conservative press, was accused of petticoat government. Eleanor wore the trousers, you know. She, as who wrote the first two volumes of her three-volume autobiography, when she was in the White House, had to say certain things. One was that I was never interested in politics. I did it for my husband, and I never tried to influence him. Letter after letter, and I quote several, she's writing to Harry Hopkins, Harry Hicks, you know, what about this, you know, is this really true that Negroes don't have the same rights in these camps? What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do, etc. So she was deeply politically committed. And this was a mutual passion. Another myth that I debunk is that she was far to the left of Franklin and sort of pulled against him. It was extraordinary, this marriage, because she calls herself the activist, and he was, you know, he was the politician, but he had to be. In order to stay in power, he had to deal with the incredibly influential Southern Democrats who were racists. Both of them were extremely keen, both Franklin and Eleanor, to bring in an anti-lynching bill. But they were dealing with the Southern Democrats. And so Eleanor was sort of able to be seen to be doing it. And Franklin had to often say to her, I can't be seen to, but why don't you push a bit more? And so on. On the question of Jews, it's interesting because Franklin is quite often accused of not doing more for Jews during the war. I read a lot about that because it fascinated me. And in actual fact, again, I'm struck that, well, first of all, America did far more than Australia, Canada, or any other Western country. Didn't do enough, but what Franklin was up against was anti-Semitism in America, which was huge, like it was everywhere else. For example, in 1939... there was a move in Congress to bring in 20,000 Jewish kids from Germany. Eleanor, with Franklin's backing, Eleanor was pushing them, trying to get this Congress, trying to maneuver people to sort of get this bill passed, with Franklin advising her. But the anti-Semitism in this country was such that somebody even commented, you know, 20,000 sweet Jewish kids will turn into 20,000 ugly adults. This is the kind of thing that they were up against. But it wasn't the case that Eleanor was doing, that was put, it wasn't the case that Eleanor was always to the left of Franklin. I think Franklin was pretty progressive, but he was a realist. He was on the front line. He had to deal with the reality. He had to maneuver the situation. Soon it was war. He had to deal with the neutrality law. I won't go into it all now, but anyway, the fact is he was dealing with the Southern Democrats and Eleanor was dealing with, you know, what Franklin would allow her to say. So they both had their hands slightly tied, but what they did was incredible.
Yes. If I understood correctly, in what way did Sarah consider Eleanor mundane?
Not really mundane, but I think that she felt sorry for Eleanor. I mean, in the Roosevelt family, and I'm talking about the whole extended tribe, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and his branch on Long Island, and then there was Franklin and his branch up the Hudson. And Eleanor was known in the family as being a terribly sad case. I mean, everything about her seems sad. You know, mother died, father died. She didn't have the most favourable jawline, as Edith Roosevelt said. She was a bit known as an ugly duckling, although, by the way, she could be actually beautiful and in her bridal dress and in her beautiful evening gowns that she wore as First Lady. And when she learnt that actually to smile, she smiled very beautifully, and that was good to do with her jawline. She can be very beautiful. But no, I think that Sarah wanted a more... Sarah probably didn't want anybody for her boy. She wanted to be...
She wanted to be the
wife herself, really. But, I mean, it would have had to be... It would have had to be a more beautiful, more mundane woman. I don't think she could see Eleanor's attributes.
One detail that you bring out very delicately is just devastating, maybe to help answer your question. Eleanor's own mother, who was a renowned beauty, referred to her daughter as Granny.
Yeah.
Called her Granny. That was her nickname because she looked so inelegant and...
As a two-year-old, she'd suck her thumb and look anguished. She felt rejected. And so her mother would sort of say, oh, come on in, Granny, you know, when she stood in the doorway with a sort of gesture of impatience. Yeah, she had a very hard childhood.
Let's get a couple more questions. Yes, in the hat. And over here down in row two. Yes.
I was intrigued by the piece in the book where you mentioned that she had a 3,000-page FBI file?
Yes.
Was that because she was a powerful woman, or did J. Edgar Hoover really see her as a threat to national security?
Isn't it incredible to think the First Lady can have one of the largest FBI files on her out there in the FBI files? Eleanor was much hated. She took some of the flack that Franklin couldn't take. And, you know, she was, I use the word apologetically, but she was constantly called a nigger lover. And in the press you see it, you know, the most remarkable things in the Southern press. I couldn't believe my eyes that you sort of... Eleanor called in to see a group of Negroes at some jamboree in the South. You know, nigger lover to the last. I mean, you know, the most awful language. And then also, this was the 1930s. It wasn't just race that got her into trouble. It was also the fact that there was a very strong left wing in the 30s. It was the Great Depression. And, in fact, not only was the Communist Party the biggest it ever was, but also it had formed a popular front with a lot of left-wing groups. I mean, it was perfectly, more or less perfectly acceptable to be a communist sympathizer, if not a communist. And Eleanor had friends who were among... Well, she had friends who were communist sympathizers. And, well, they both did. They both regularly had people at the White House dinner table, young people who, you know, were known to be anything was interesting at the Roosevelt dinner table. They wanted to hear different viewpoints. And so, you know, she got into a lot of trouble for this. And the FBI tried to make out that she and her friend Joe Lash, a young man she was very fond of, who had a girlfriend, but, you know, I think she had a great need to love this young man, even though he was the age of her kids. He was, you know, an immigrant Jewish left-winger, and the FBI ridiculously tried to make out that they were having an affair and... you know, that they were sort of working on some conspiracy. There was always a conspiracy involved in the FBI files. I've seen many at this point. So, I mean, it's extraordinary, really, as you say.
Winston Churchill spent a great deal of time at the White House, especially during World War II. Could you comment on what Eleanor thought of Winston Churchill and also a little bit about Franklin's thoughts?
Oh, I wish I could find the passage about that because it's really very funny. But, I mean, Franklin liked him. He thought he was a sort of strange, eccentric Englishman. They had in common a great love of history and the Navy and so on. Eleanor thought that Winston was a fuddy-duddy sort of leftover British imperialist who had a great deal of trouble separating himself from India. And, I mean, Franklin thought that too, but Eleanor was more impatient with him. And he went around, you know, he drank a lot. She didn't like that. He kept Franklin up at the most awful hours because he'd sleep in, but Franklin had to work and, you know, it would be 1 o'clock bedtime for Franklin. So Franklin was exhausted when Winston left. And now he went around in this sort of funny siren suit. That's the bit I was wanting to read to you because he had this kind of zip-up little suit that he wore. In any way, he looked a bit like a baby with his sort of pink face. And so Eleanor... and with his perpetual dummy, which was a bottle of something or other. I mean, dummy, you say pacifier in this country. Anyway, so she thought that, she said to her friend Jo Lash, "I'm buying one of those siren suits for FDR for his birthday." She thought Winston a bit of a joke, but he came on very dangerous trips on boats across the Atlantic to visit Franklin. I mean, Franklin during the war was the leader of the Allies. He in his map room, he was really and the number one, and Winston hugely admired Franklin. He cried too when he died.
Two more questions. Yes, over there.
Two comments. One about how was she able to have the adoration of the population, whereas when we saw a strong first lady in Hillary Clinton, it was quite devastating. Can you comment on that?
Well, Hillary did have, I mean, it wasn't always devastating, but I know I don't think I can answer that question. I think it's a real question that hangs there. I agree with you. It's astounding. Franklin, when he went on his campaign trains, in those days he took the train across the country, which is a really good way of seeing depressed America out of the windows, whereas now, of course, you just fly everywhere. But when Eleanor didn't appear, the crowds shouted for her. They wanted her. But, I mean, she was, just like Franklin, she was as much hated as she was loved. They dealt with tremendous hatred. I mean, I cannot emphasize enough what hatred they also got. So, in many ways, same sort of stuff that Obama is dealing with. You know, a predominantly conservative press and a whole... Eleanor was caricatured brutally for her looks. I mean, she had to just stand above that and not care about the fact that she was constantly caricatured with, you know, buck teeth and so on. It would have been devastating for most of us women, for anybody. But, you know, they dealt with that. The one thing when you were saying that they did indeed make the White... I was going to read you that passage, but there wasn't time. They made the White House into a most amazing community. Many people of their... many friends lived there. But I was thinking that's something Obama couldn't do. He couldn't stack the White House with his friends, or as a black man, he'd be accused of lowering the real estate value or something. I mean, there are things that Obama can't do, to be honest, that Franklin could get away with.
Partly because the press wasn't covering it as closely, you know.
Yes.
They were more respectful.
The press was more respectful, it has to be said, yeah.
I also wanted to ask, do you see a lot of similarities in the marriage of the Clintons with the Roosevelts?
Not really, I must say, not really. One of the things I don't want to talk too much about the Clintons, but one of the things I really do admire about the Roosevelts was their politics was really about public service. And this was something that they much admired in Theodore Roosevelt too. And, you know, Franklin in the last year of his life was dying. I mean, it was clear that he was a dying man. But Eleanor and Franklin took the view that our men are out there dying on the battlefields. We've got a job here, President and First Lady. We're on the battlefields too. If we go down dying, I mean, we've got to go down dying. They gave up their private lives, really, for public service. You see when you read the book, I mean, it's very interesting because I talk about the intimate White House life, but, I mean, it was all tailored around getting things done. It was about politics, and it was a common passion that they shared.
And a lot of their closest people gave up their private lives to accomplish what they needed them to accomplish. That's another very interesting thing that comes out in the book, is the devotion of their of their associates. One more question from this side. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to find out if there's anything you have to say about the children, what they've become, or that they have the looks of Eleanor, or...
They had one daughter, Anna, who was very beautiful, and then they had five sons, one of whom died at 10 months, so they had four. So they had five children. Good-looking, all of them. But not great successes. You know, I guess I cannot pretend that Franklin was a good father or that Eleanor was a good mother. They were away too much. They were too busy. Anyway, they were American aristocracy. The kids were sent to Groton at the age of 12, you know, New England boarding school, just like the British aristocracy, and learnt to toughen up, you know, cold showers and run before breakfast and no walks in pairs, just in case. And even the headmaster encouraged what he called pumping. I mean, if you were a rebel, that was dunking your head down the toilet. And then sometimes people passed out. I mean, so it was about community. I was amazed at the picture of Groton back then under Peabody, as he was called, the president of Groton. It was very austere. And the kids were sent there. But later on they rather tended to like alcohol a bit too much, and they married five kids, 21 marriages. So they weren't too good at marriage either.
Some of them also came out with like a tell-all that was kind of antagonistic toward their mother particularly.
Yes, that's right, unfortunately. But, you know, one of the things I had to do writing this book was to take all these things. I had to read very carefully between the lines. There's a lot, I mean, even the children wrote with the help of ghostwriters and, you know, published by Playboy Press Chicago. There was definitely pressure on James Roosevelt to suggest that, you know, his father did have an affair with Lucy Mercer and that they found the motel register. Well, there weren't motels back then for a start, and the register's never been found, and that was, you know, strictly speaking, bullshit.
Well,
on that note...
Yeah, on that note. But the book isn't. It's just such, as you can tell from our brief discussion, mesmerizing read. Thank you all for coming. I want to remind you also, join the Library Foundation. It's a great cause. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.